The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 22/November 29, 2021. As usual, it is bordered in red with a very minuscule inner border of white, a blue-striped background that looks almost like corrugated cardboard or plastic. Forms the backdrop upon which is superimposed time in white and gray in large block letters. Above that, the caption reads, Best Inventions of 2021. And there are a few things displayed here. Some are photographs of actual objects. Some look like they're photoshopped and superimposed upon this cover. A savvier way to commute, which indicates some kind of a little cell phone device with a map. A smarter slip-on running shoe in pastel rainbow colors with no laces to tie. A longer-lasting laptop. And we see here just the corner of a screen of a laptop with a few of the components floating nearby. A globe on a pedestal, a more accurate world map, something that looks like a robotic insect, a DIY robotic arm, a sleeker mouthwash, and this looks like a copper-colored urn, a simpler way to focus. This appears to be a very futuristic alarm clock, a tiny car, a mini car that teaches coding, and something that looks to me like a Frito-Lay product. It says Next Gen Noodles. Moving then to For the Record in this new edition of Time. £155 million donation made by Vietnamese billionaire Nguyen T. Phuong Thao to Oxford University's Linacre College, which will now be named Thao, T-H-A-O, College. The college announced November 1. All I am doing is thinking about my child, from Saraya, S-U-R-A-Y-A. Mother of a baby handed to U.S. soldiers during chaotic evacuations at the airport in Kabul, August 19. Months later, the baby is still unaccounted for, Reuters reported November 5. A pantomime election that was neither free nor fair, Joe Biden said, the U.S. president, in a November statement condemning Nicaragua's President Daniel Ortega's re-election. 24, the number of U.S. state legislatures that have introduced bills aiming to restrict teaching and training, primarily related to race, racism, and gender, in schools and workplaces in 2021, according to a PEN America report published November 8. My wing is feeling a little sore, said Big Bird, the Sesame Street Muppet, sharing his COVID-19 vaccination status and its after effects in a November 6 tweet. They have a nice spiciness to them, a little bit of a lingering burn, said Megan MacArthur, NASA astronaut, describing the flavor of the first chili peppers grown in space in a November 6 interview. 83. age of M.J. Sonny Everhart, who on November 7 became the oldest hiker to complete the Appalachian Trail. "I will abide by the results of this poll, whichever way it goes," said Elon Musk, Tesla CEO, in a November 6 Twitter poll that asked if he should sell 10% of his Tesla stock, valued at roughly $21 billion. 57.9% of respondents said he should. From the brief Zero Hour by Ciara Nugent, the world's largest carbon emitters now all have net zero pledges. Most of them are vague. In a surprise announcement during the opening days of COP26, the UN Climate Summit taking place in Glasgow over the first 2 weeks of November, India, the world's third largest emitter of greenhouse gases, pledged to reach net zero emissions by 2070. The announcement means all five of the world's largest emitters now have a net zero target, a date by which they intend to add no more carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere than they take out. Climate scientists say the world needs to cut human-caused CO2 emissions by 45% from 2010 levels by 2030 and reach net zero around 2050, lest global warming rise more than 1.5 centigrade degrees above pre-industrial levels. That is the point at which climate change impacts become much worse for much of the world. Avoiding it was the aim of the 2015 Paris Agreement, the result of the last major UN summit. And with a flurry of similar pledges made by countries before or during COP26, 87% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions and 89% of its economy are now covered by net zero targets, although with differing time frames. That is a seismic shift in global climate politics. In less than a decade, net zero emissions has gone from being a concept used by scientific researchers to a vague mention in the Paris Agreement to an established goal for nearly 139 nations, including some which have been previously most resistant to climate action. If you'd asked me even a year ago at COP26, will we see India, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Australia, or Russia walking out with commitment to get to net zero emissions? I would have said that'd be very optimistic, says Thomas Hale, associate professor in global public policy at the University of Oxford and part of the Oxford Net Zero Research Project on cutting emissions. It is really evidence of a tipping point dynamic where something seems impossible and becomes possible, starting with the work of climate activists and developing countries who pushed it into the Paris Agreement. But there's a major caveat to climate advocates' enthusiasm for the rise of net zero pledges. The adoption of a target does not mean a country's on track to wean its economy off the fossil fuels that produce most greenhouse gas emissions in time to stop the worst of climate change, or that it even intends to do so. Different governments have very different visions for what net zero will look like. And climate advocates warn many of them will not be sufficient. Rather than cutting their emissions quickly, some major polluters, including Australia and Saudi Arabia, are planning to rely heavily on offsetting them by capturing carbon from the air or paying other nations to grow forests. Other countries' pledges involve targets of 2050 or 2060, but without setting an earlier interim target to ensure they start cutting emissions in the next few years, which scientists say is essential. and the vast majority of countries with net zero pledges have not produced detailed plans for how they will start on the groundwork. According to Oxford's Net Zero Tracker, launched by Hale and colleagues the week before COP26, only a fraction are meaningful commitments with clear plans attached. In fact, just 18% of global emissions and 27% of global GDP are covered by these robust pledges. And even countries that do have strong pledges may not be acting as fast as they need to in order to meet them. For example, the UK, host country for COP26, has laid out a detailed plan to meet an ambitious target of reducing emissions by 78% compared with 1990 levels by 2035 and reaching net zero by 2050. But it is still considering approving new oil fields off the coast of Scotland. The International Energy Agency said in May committing to new fossil fuel projects was incompatible with reaching net zero by 2050. The pledges being made represent the start, not the end, of efforts to get the world on track. But youth activists at COP26 fear that governments' focus on setting the targets for decades from now is a way to delay the complicated and expensive work of lowering emissions now. Under all the emissions commitments submitted to the UN as of November 2, which do not include recent, vague net zero pledges not backed up by plans, global emissions would rise by 13.7% by 2030. This is a 2-week-long celebration of business as usual and blah, 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 activist Greta Thunberg said of the conference while addressing a large protest in Glasgow, November 5. The voices of future generations are drowning in their greenwashing, empty words and promises. Hale agrees. A net zero pledge alone is obviously not sufficient, but he hopes the targets will make it easier for the public and campaigners to push governments and businesses to get on track to meeting them. The targets have really clarified what the direction of travel is, he says. Now, rather than discussing the goal, we are discussing how quickly we can get there, which is a much more productive place to be. Time has added a small graphic chart in the middle of this page, the road to net zero. I shall attempt to describe this to you. Here are the world's 8 highest CO2-emitting countries and the extent of their current net zero commitments. This is arranged in columns and then in a grid format. Commitment status, and there are going to be 8 countries listed in the first column. Net zero target, applicable to each, and then the commitment status, which is either in discussion, pledged, in policy, or in law. And then the final column is share of global CO2 emissions. This appears to be reading from top to bottom in terms of the share of global CO2 emissions, beginning with China, net zero target 2060 in policy, 28.9% share. The U.S. net zero target 2050 in policy. The share is 15%. India net zero target 2070 pledged and the share 7.4%. Russia net zero target 2060 pledged. The share of global emissions 4.8%. Japan, net zero target 2050, in law, and the share is 3.1%. Iran, net zero target none, and no commitment status, and the share is 2.2%. Germany, net zero target 2045, and that is the earliest of these mentioned. It's in law, and their share is 2%. Finally, Indonesia, net zero target 2060, in discussion, and the share of global CO2 emissions is 1.8%. More of the brief news here in a column with 1, 2, 3 short articles. Japan sued over abrupt executions. Two death row inmates in Japan launched a legal challenge November 4 against the country's practice of executing prisoners with only a few hours' notice. Their lawyer, who called the method extremely inhumane, said the pair also seek 22 million yen, or $194,000, in compensation. Viral distress signal leads to teens' rescue. A 16-year-old car passenger was rescued from a Kentucky highway November 4 after making a hand signal, recently popularized on TikTok, to indicate she was in danger. A driver recognized the signal, in which the teen folded her thumb into her palm before clenching her fingers over it. And the driver notified police, who later arrested a 61-year-old man on a charge of unlawful imprisonment. U.S. journalist faces charges in Myanmar amid increasing crackdowns on opposition figures by the country's ruling military junta. Prosecutors in Myanmar have filed sedition and terrorism charges against U.S. journalist Danny Fenster, his lawyer said November 10. Already behind bars for 5 months, Fenster could now face life in prison. Here's a photograph. Well, it's under an overpass, a huge concrete overpass. There are a group of women, 2, 4, 6 in the foreground, wearing what I would describe as saris, but I could be wrong. Many of them have very colorful attire, including shawls and head coverings. I shouldn't say many. There are only 2, 4, 6 of them in the picture. But between two of them is some kind of a drapery holding a number of multicolored pastel balloons. And also in the background, it appears to be snow. And behind the background of snow, still under the overpass, is another group of people. They're indiscernible to me. I see what look like men, but it could be a mixed group. And beyond that, it just dims. It's like fog or haze or smog. So, Fouled Waters is the title of this colorful photo. And the caption is written by Jennifer Duggan, D-U-G-G-A-N. Hindu devotees bathe among clumps of toxic foam in the Yamuna River in New Delhi, November 10. As part of rituals during the four-day Shahat Puja Festival. I will spell that, and I apologize for mispronouncing it. Shahath space Puja Festival. During Shahat Puja celebrations, which are dedicated to the sun god, Lord Surya, it is traditional to bathe and pray in holy waters. The foam, which has been appearing more regularly on the river, is formed by sewage and pollution containing phosphates. Here's a bulletin by Abby Vasoulis. U.S. taxpayers bankrolled General Electric. Then it moved its workforce overseas. GE, which November 9 announced it will divide itself into three public companies, aviation, healthcare, and energy, has seen a 75% decline in its domestic labor force since 1989. Per a new report from Cornell University and the University of Massachusetts, Boston, that is a drop from 277,000 to just 70,000 U.S. workers. Noteworthy, the report says, because of the state and federal taxpayer grants and subsidies GE received while disinvesting in the U.S. economy. Cashing in, GE has drawn more than $2.2 billion in public funds since 1992. according to data compiled by Good Jobs First, a nonprofit economic watchdog. The company contests this figure. GE's reliance on subsidies is indisputable, says Nick Jurovich, a primary author of the report and the associate director of the Labor Resource Center at UMass Boston, as is our government's willingness to continue awarding them, despite its rampant offshoring. Paychecks. GE's offshoring of manufacturing jobs is most clearly felt by U.S. workers themselves, but there's also a multiplier effect apparent, says Arthur Wheaton, the report's other primary author and director of Western NY Labor and Environmental Programs for Cornell's Worker Institute. A dollar doesn't just go to the employees, it goes through the community, Wheaton explains. And that has a major impact when you're cutting thousands and thousands of jobs. Future proof. The researchers maintain directing a fire hose of public funds at GE as it simultaneously wound down domestic manufacturing represents a lost opportunity for supporting a healthier U.S. economy and for fighting climate change. There is a huge amount of growth here, says Jurovich, of opportunities in the renewable energy market. The question is whether it's going to benefit American workers. More from the brief news, Q&A. What's behind America's white juror problem? And there's a photograph here that is occurring in a courtroom. There's a man and a woman, both dressed in blue suits, while the woman's also wearing black pants, and the man's wearing a bright orange necktie. Behind them are seated several more people at dark wood tables. The caption reads, attorneys confer November 9, prior to the start of the trial in connection with Arbery's death in Brunswick, Georgia. In November, nearly all-white juries were seated in two high-profile trials, that of Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin and that involving the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. The judge in the latter noted that jury selection seemed to have involved intentional discrimination. Samuel Summers, chair of the psychology department at Tufts University, studies racial inequities in institutions such as the criminal justice system. He explained to Time why the racial composition of the jury matters. Time asks the question here, and Summers answers. Time, when you heard a nearly all-white jury had been seated in the Ahmaud Arbery case, what immediately came to mind? Summers, what comes to mind immediately? This happens a lot. It is not unusual, unfortunately, that juries do not feel like they're particularly representative of the communities from which they are drawn. And in particular, it is often that the juries are whiter than the communities from which they're drawn. Time, why is that the case? Summers, there are obstacles to creating a diverse jury pool to begin with. Many jurisdictions use things like voter registration rolls or utility bills or DMV records. Underrepresented tend to be people who move around more often or who do not own property, who are renters and who are less likely to register to vote. So some studies show you get an underrepresentation of young people, people of color, people of lower socioeconomic status. And then you've got a system that still has these peremptory challenges, even though you are not allowed by Supreme Court rule to base challenges on race and gender. That's a very difficult prohibition to enforce. It is not hard for people to generate a neutral explanation for a challenge. Time. What else should people know as these two trials proceed? One of which I'm editing here has already concluded. Anyway, the answer from Summers. When juries are more homogeneous, people feel like the system's less fair. And that is important to consider by itself. No one's arguing that we know what's going to happen now because we know the jury's racial composition, but it does matter. The race of a defendant in a case, the race of a victim in the case. our own racial and ethnic identity, these things shape how we see the world around us. The scientific data are very clear on that point. And that article was written by Janelle Ross. Now, the next is under the small subject heading, the U.S. admitted no Uyghur refugees last year. Here's why. Now, I may be mispronouncing Uyghur, so I'll spell it. U-I-G-H-U-R. And this short article, which is barely a column long, was written by Jasmine Aguilera. Both the Biden and Trump administrations have condemned China's persecution of Uyghurs, which a November 9 report from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum claims is growing in scale and severity, and formally declared the country's treatment of the mostly Muslim minority group a genocide. But the U.S. has admitted zero Uyghur refugees in the past two fiscal years. The main reason is logistical. It is next to impossible for Uyghurs in China, most of whom are under extraordinary state surveillance in the country's Xinjiang region, to access refugee resettlement systems. Millions are also being held in mass detention camps. China, which has consistently refuted allegations and evidence of human rights violations, has also pressured other nations to return Uyghurs who've escaped. For Uyghurs, there's really nowhere to go, says Maya Wang, a senior China researcher in the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch. Addressing the central issue, helping Uyghurs inside China access refugee systems, would require intense pressure from world leaders and may be nearly impossible given geopolitics in the region, experts say. But there are steps the U.S. can take, like fast-tracking the resettlement of Uyghurs who've already left China, and in an October 21 letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, 16 members of Congress called on the department to step up pressure on foreign countries to end all deportation efforts to Xinjiang and to ensure the safety of those who do not wish to return. One more page here of the brief news. First, the column with three short articles. EU slams Belarus's cross-border tactics. On November 9, the EU accused Belarus of employing gangster-style behavior in its border standoff with Poland. The EU claims the Russia-backed state has encouraged migrants to cross illegally into Poland in response to sanctions imposed upon it for human rights abuses. China war games with mock U.S. ships. Amid rising tensions over Taiwan, China has built mock-ups in the shape of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier and U.S. warships for apparent use in naval warfare training exercises, according to a November 8 satellite images reviewed by the U.S. Naval Institute, a nonprofit military association. DOJ sues Texas over new voter laws. Restrictions placed on absentee ballots and assistance at the polls in a voting rights law approved by Texas lawmakers in September unfairly impinge on voters' access, particularly for elderly and disabled people and those not proficient in English, the Department of Justice claimed in a lawsuit filed against the state November 4. Good question. This is written by Alana Samuels, Los Angeles. Have U.S. shoppers broken the supply chain? America has long gobbled up more goods from overseas than it sends back. But in the past year, spending has gone bonkers. Americans imported $240 billion worth of goods in September, up 16% from September 2019. Meanwhile, the country exported about $81 billion less than it imported, a record trade deficit, according to data released by the U.S. Census Bureau November 4. Spending will likely continue apace as consumers stock up for the holidays. People largely stopped shopping in March 2020 as they hunkered down amid the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, so shipping companies deployed containers for other tasks. When e-commerce spending started booming that summer, shipping containers were stranded in ports across the world. As backlogs grew, factories everywhere could no longer rely on the global supply chain to get them the parts they needed quickly, which meant delays in getting products to consumers. Meanwhile, big retailers rushed to load up warehouses to try and get goods to customers soon after they were ordered online. Americans have become singularly impatient consumers, says Jock O'Connell, an international trade advisor at Beacon Economics. We have much more inventory in this country than we would need if Jeff Bezos had not convinced us we could have our stuff delivered tomorrow. Because there are so many more goods coming into the nation, U.S. ports are clogged. Consumer spending is usually good for the economy, but the bottlenecks created by America's huge appetite are becoming a problem for economic growth. The U.S. economy grew at a rate of just 2% from July to September, the Commerce Department said October 28. Down significantly from the 6.7% it grew the quarter before, largely because of supply chain bottlenecks. We are in the midst of unprecedented cargo congestion, said Gene Soroka, executive director of the Port of Los Angeles, October 29. The system is all gummed up. Because there is no more room to unload, longshoremen's shifts are getting cut, and because there's nowhere to put the containers, cranes sit idle. And retailers cannot get all the products they ordered months ago, which could lead to empty shelves ahead of the holiday season. These bottlenecks are pushing the U.S. further in the direction of an economy that consumes things but does not make them. Maersk, M-A-E-R-S-K, says the U.S. accounted for much of the second quarter's 3% increase over 2019 in demand for shipping containers, as well as for the 63% increase in what the shipping giant can charge for transporting one. Merchants in the U.S. are doing what they can to get goods across the ocean and to shoppers ahead of the holidays, and they're holding their breath to see if U.S. consumers will put up with higher prices. Charlene Anderson, who sells craft supplies on Amazon, says she is going to have to raise prices 15%. Even then, she is worried about inventory arriving in time. It's not going to be a fun thing to answer all those "you ruined my Christmas" emails, she says. She recommends people do their holiday shopping now, because once products are sold out, replacements won't be available until the new year. Milestones: reopened U.S. borders, an end to a long COVID-19 closure. In March 2020, American skies went strangely quiet. In an effort to control the pandemic, the U.S. banned travelers from 33 countries. Flights from Europe, China, Brazil, India, South Africa, and more were canceled, alongside land crossings from Canada and Mexico. All that changed November 8, as the White House threw open the gates to most international travelers, as long as they show proof of vaccination and can present a negative COVID-19 test. The move could be a tonic for the U.S. economy. The ban has cost an estimated $300 billion in tourist spending and 1 million jobs, per the U.S. Travel Association. But that is less relevant to the millions free to travel again than the reunions made possible after a year and a half apart. Couples separated by continents will embrace again. Friends long reduced to Zoom will unite face to face. Grandparents will meet grandchildren who were born during the travel freeze. Pandemics are cruel things. Their gradual end can be deeply sweet. Jeffrey Kluger wrote that article, and Andrew Chow wrote this one, Died, Astroworld Concertgoers, Music Festival Tragedy. There's a photo here of the, I think, Houston skyline against a deep blue sky. Lots of buildings and trees in between that distant skyline and the current photographic subject. Surrounded by large buildings, perhaps hotels or perhaps apartment buildings, is a rather bizarre-looking backdrop, like something from a Disney ride, only not as good. It's charcoal. I'll say charcoal gray, and it's pointy. There are 2, 4, 5 points, as if they're promontories on a mountain, and they're kind of edged in an icing-like color and texture of tan. So there's this tan thing, tan and charcoal gray thing, in front of which are empty spaces, large empty spaces, like a large, like quadrants of the parking lots of drive-in theaters used to be. And then there are tall rigs of lighting and probably press boxes or sound and lighting rooms in the foreground. And the caption reads, debris around the Astroworld main stage, November 8, days after 8 people were killed in a crowd disturbance at the concert. 8 people died and hundreds more were injured at the Astroworld Festival in Houston, November 5, when a crowd of some 50,000 people, eager to see the rapper Travis Scott, pressed relentlessly toward the main stage. Scott prides himself on the ferocity of his live shows and has been arrested twice for encouraging his fans to storm his stages. November 5, many in the audience surged violently upon his arrival, causing some people to fall. This in turn resulted in additional panic. People began passing out in the middle of the scrum, where it was hard for them to escape or receive aid. Concert medics have also said they were dangerously understaffed. The show continued for at least half an hour after officials declared a mass casualty event. Videos of concertgoers screaming, "Stop the show," to no avail, circulated widely on social media. Other clips showed individuals being crowd-surfed to safety. Scott did pause his set at least once to direct security to help unconscious people. Extremely young concertgoers were among the dead, including 2 teenagers. The 6 other victims were confirmed as people in their 20s. At least 18 civil lawsuits have already been filed seeking damages for death or injuries, with Scott, the rapper Drake, who performed on stage alongside him, and Live Nation Entertainment, Inc., the festival's promoter, among those named as defendants. Injury lawyers are seeking settlements in the millions of dollars. Local authorities, meanwhile, have begun an investigation into whether the festival's organizers were criminally negligent. More milestones here in a column. Died Marilia Mendonca, popular sertanejo singer-songwriter, in a plane crash in Brazil, November 5 at 26. Sued, a California fertility clinic, after 2 couples gave birth to each other's babies in an alleged embryo mix-up, per November 8 court filings. Announced, long-time NBC News anchor Brian Williams' departure from the network, he said, November 10. Removed, a post shared by Ethiopian Prime Minister and 2019 Nobel Peace Laureate Abiy Ahmed on Facebook, November 2, after the platform ruled it was inciting and supporting violence. Suspended, publication of Ukraine's oldest English-language newspaper, the Kyiv Post, November 8, as its reporters accused its oligarch owner of infringing on editorial independence. approved, the first pill designed to treat symptomatic COVID-19 by UK medicine regulators, the British government announced November 4. Married, women's equality advocate and Nobel Prize winner, Malala Yousafzai, November 9. Confirmed, Beth Robinson to the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals by the U.S. Senate, November 1, making her the first out LGBTQ woman to serve on a federal circuit. Here is The View with Health, the subtopic, How to Keep Kids Safe by Monica Gandhi and Jeff Vergalis. Gandhi, M.D., is a professor of medicine and associate division chief of infectious diseases at San Francisco General Hospital. Vergalis, M.D., M.S., is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Virginia. With the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine newly given emergency use authorization for children 5 to 11, many parents are asking the question, should we vaccinate our kids? Many of them may have already made up their mind. Some of those arguing against vaccinating kids make the case COVID-19 typically does not cause severe illness among children with healthy immune systems. Thankfully, purely as a percentage of total cases, it does hold true. To date, around 6 million children in the U.S. have contracted this coronavirus, which has led to more than 65,000 hospitalizations and 897 deaths. These numbers pale in comparison to the over 3 million hospitalizations among U.S. adults and a staggering 754,000 deaths. The low rates of complications and severe illness from COVID-19 in children are the exact data needed to justify a swift return to normality for many kids. They underscore schools should be open. Recreational activities can continue as scheduled. Children should be allowed to socialize with one another in a normal fashion. Mask mandates need an end date, and we should minimize learning loss from exposures. Yet the argument that kids are, for the most part, unaffected medically by COVID-19 ignores a simple yet essential premise. Children are not supposed to die. The denominator of how many kids have contracted COVID-19 is so vast, it makes it easy to ignore the very small numerator. Although the low likelihood of severe illness in children should continue to drive our public policy, the fact that there are children who succumb to this illness needs to drive our vaccination guidelines. To put it in perspective, COVID-19 would currently rank 8th on the list of causes of adolescent death over the past year. Trauma, including motor vehicle accidents, drowning, firearm incidents, suffocation, and other injuries, dominates the majority of childhood deaths and drives advancement of seatbelt laws, car seat laws, firearm laws, and swimming pool laws to reduce this number. Cancer, mental health disorders, and heart disease come next, and our massive focuses of research spending and medical advances aimed at improving survival of these conditions. Although all of these events are rare, just like deaths of children from COVID, they absolutely do occur and are devastating for families. Yet none of these conditions has a preventive strategy as profoundly effective as immunity to COVID-19. We vaccinate children to prevent severe illness and death, not to prevent mild disease. It is the same reason pediatricians emphasize influenza vaccination, not to prevent all kids from getting the flu, but to protect at-risk children from hospitalization and death. This remains true for the other 14 pediatric immunizations the CDC recommends, and nearly every state requires. The goal is to prevent severe disease in children, keeping children alive and healthy. The vaccine must also be safe to be effective. COVID vaccines have now been given to more than 4 billion people worldwide, with the safety data clear. Furthermore, the vaccine prevented 90.7% of COVID infections in children. In pediatrics, we're used to prescribing medications off-label, meaning not for their initial intended purpose or age range. We do so because we frequently lack clinical trial data in kids and have to base medical decision-making on assumptions and very small studies. With the conclusion of the current trial, pediatricians will be prescribing this vaccine with more data and knowledge behind it than virtually any other medicine we routinely administer. We will base this on billions of real-world examples in adults and thousands of kids in a clinical trial. Although that might not be enough for many parents, that is vastly more data than have been used to validate other medications we already give kids. So where did we lose our way? Parents who previously vaccinated their children for other illnesses up to this point remain hesitant to give the COVID-19 vaccine, even though the rationale, safety profile, and approval process are identical. We need to return to our usual approach to childhood vaccination by recognizing that a one-size-fits-all strategy is impractical and ineffective. Conversations and medical decision-making surrounding childhood need to leave the political sphere and return to the doctor's office. We should not be discussing the necessity of vaccinating children against COVID-19. Instead, we should be determining the best way to do it. An Ancient Hack for Anxiety. This is by Julia Hotz. Some 2,000 years ago, in the throes of a targeted chase to the death, a Roman philosopher named Seneca had a thought. What's the worst that can happen? Today, a growing body of research suggests that a Seneca-inspired exercise, inviting the worried brain to literally envision its worst fears realized, is one of the most evidence-based treatments for anxiety. In scientific terms, that exercise is called imaginal exposure, or facing the thing you're most afraid of by summoning it in your mind, says Regine Galanti, founder of Long Island Behavioral Psychology and a licensed clinical psychologist who regularly interrogates imaginal exposure into her therapy. As a subset of cognitive behavioral therapy, imaginal exposure relies on simple logic. Just as anxiety is created in your head, it can also be squashed in your head. That's why a growing brigade of psychologists are finding ways to help people do imaginal exposure in their own homes on their own terms. So, how does it work? Galanti advises her clients to jot down whatever is causing them anxiety, and then to pick a specific time, ideally not before bed, to revisit those concerns. The reason why this works is that it sets boundaries. So when a worry comes up at 9 a.m., you can say, hey, not now, your time is coming. Galanti says people rarely use the full 15 minutes of allotted worry time, but it helps put anxiety into perspective. Sometimes when you hit your worry list, you might find that the thing that bugged you at 9 a.m. that you thought would be the end of the world is actually not bugging you anymore at all. Here is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, the dispiriting truth about the latest violence in Iraq. On November 7, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi survived a pre-dawn assassination attempt by armed drones, which descended on his home in Baghdad and wounded six guards. Iraq's Interior Ministry suspects Iran-backed Shiite militia groups, which are furious that an alliance of pro-Iran parties lost two-thirds of its seats in October. The alliance's leader denies any involvement in the attack. Okay, we're talking about Iraqi prime minister and some alliance of pro-Iran parties. Okay. It is not clear what anyone could gain from this assault, even if it had succeeded. The post-election process of forming a new government is the central point of contention in Iraq at the moment. But the prime minister has virtually no role to play, nor is he a powerful politician. He is a compromise candidate without a reliable political base of support who answers to the parties that back him. The attacks will only boost his profile, which does not serve the interests of any of Iraq's main power brokers. It is possible this attack was simply a spontaneous act of retaliation by a militia group following the killing of pro-militia protesters by security troops in November, a sign of continuing chaos in Baghdad rather than of a coup attempt. Baghdad has denounced the attack. We should not be surprised, though many militia groups stoking violence in Iraq have Iran's backing. This assassination attempt is not good for Tehran either. It throws gasoline on anti-Iranian anger in parts of Iraq and across the Middle East, and puts their militia allies in Iraq more directly in harm's way. For now, the biggest question for Iraq's future is what effect this traumatic news will have on the process of forming a new post-election government. Political parties linked to militias have refused to accept the result of that vote. In fact, full and final results have not been made public a month after votes were cast, stoking fears among those who performed poorly that backstage vote manipulation will cost them even more seats than first projected, and more of the privileges and access to wealth that come with a role in Iraq's government. But the attack on the prime minister should make clear that continuing uncertainty over who will now wield power in Iraq will increase the risk of even more deadly violence. The current government was formed in 2019 in response to the killing of large numbers of protesters by security forces and then powerful Shiite militias. For now, the violence appears limited to elite groups and political figures jockeying for power. If Iraq's instability boils over to much broader public interest, violence will be harder to contain. There's also the risk that a single dramatic act of violence will trigger a larger confrontation that few of the major players in Iraq really want. For example, an angry prime minister might try to use Iraq's armed forces to retaliate against those he blames for the assassination attempt, and any perceived act of personal vengeance might let loose armed groups that do not answer to the power brokers inside Iraq or Iran. The Iraqi military has so far shown no appetite for that kind of conflict. A generation has passed since the George W. Bush administration argued democracy could quell violence among Iraq's warring factions. Unfortunately, the reality remains that the counting of votes and the sharing of power still leave men with guns keenly focused on threats rather than opportunities. There are no signs of this changing soon. Here's a two-page photo layout, a white polar bear front and center, behind which look like lava-invoked rocks. There's a whole wall of rocks, whether they're from lava or not. It's called Lightbox Hideout. The photograph is by Damon Winter, The New York Times. A polar bear nestles among the rocks of Bird Cove on the rugged coastline of Churchill, Manitoba, October 29. The Canadian town, situated in the south of the Arctic, has long billed itself as the polar bear capital of the world, but warming temperatures have brought a sharp decline in bear numbers. Without them, Carlene Spence, a cook at the Lazy Bear Lodge, told the New York Times, "We don't make money." Here is basically only a headline. Sports, a new payday for teen basketball stars by Sean Gregory, Atlanta. Most high school hoops players across America, if they're lucky, travel to their games in a yellow school bus. They might compete in front of the local junior college scout. But members of Overtime Elite, OTE, the new professional basketball league for top 16 to 19-year-olds, arrive in style to play before a far more influential audience. On a crisp autumn morning in Atlanta, more than two dozen OTE pros stepped off a stretch limo bus, one by one. The players entered the brand new 103,000 square foot facility constructed by Overtime, a 5-year-old digital sports media startup that built a huge following, posting Zion Williamson's high school dunks on Instagram. And there are a few photos accompanying this article, which was severely abridged, showing young men in orange and blue uniforms in a very fancy auditorium shooting hoops. Some more on the floor in black and white uniforms. They're all at this Overtime Elite's new arena in Atlanta. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.